Welcome to Tales from a Bibliophile, a bookish podcast about all things reading and the communities that books create. We're so glad you're here. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Carly Gorn Stewart, and this week's guest is a return guest that I'm very excited about. Brisa Ramirez is here with us again. Hi, Brisa.
Hello. I'm so happy to be back.
We are so excited. I am so excited. I do that a lot with the podcast. I say we because it feels weird to say I, but it's just me.
You and your cats.
Me and my cats. Odin and Blair are very excited. They're very confused about the mic setup in my house right now. They've never seen it before, but one of them's ignoring it. Actually, they're both ignoring it at this point. But yes, we're very excited to have you back. You can find, if you are unfamiliar with Brisa, we have an episode talking about disability representation in books several episodes ago. I should have picked up the exact number, but if you scroll back a bit, she's in there. It was a great conversation. And then you can also find her on Instagram and TikTok, and then Goodreads and Storygraph, all under the same name, which is Breezy Reading, B-R-E-E-Z-Y Reading. And she has great taste in books and reads a lot of really interesting things. So she's definitely worth a follow on any of those platforms. I have TikTok, but I don't use it. I watch things. I tried to make TikToks for like 5 seconds. Much like I tried to do like a bookstagram, and I just don't have the like attention span, I think, but it's always fun to watch yours.
Oh, I appreciate that. I actually started, like, I made one and then like 5 months passed by. I made another one and then like 3 months passed by. So it took me a minute, you know, to like settle into it, but I think I have found my groove there now.
It's really fun, and I love the bookish content on TikTok. I think that's there's a lot of really, both that and Instagram or Bookstagram has been around for a while now, but, and so TikTok has kind of been around for a minute now, but the bookish, I'm new to the bookish content on TikTok, I guess we should say, within the last year or so, and so I find it all very fun. And so it's interesting to see. I did like, I don't know, 6 TikToks, and I had a lot of fun with them, but then I was like, this is exhausting. Like, I feel like it's the same with Bookstagram. Like, you, I don't know. And
it requires more, like it requires.
Yes, exactly. And that could very easily be said about a podcast because it does require so much work, but like, podcasting just comes so much more naturally to me, and I feel like I have more ideas for podcasting than I do like a Bookstagram or a TikTok. So we can jump into what we're reading. Are you reading anything good right now?
I am currently reading Unseelie by Evelise Hausman. It's about a changeling. It's about twin sisters, and one of them is a changeling. And there's like the author's note at the beginning talks about how she was inspired by this theory that changelings are actually like autistic children.
Oh, interesting.
And so the author is autistic and the main character is autistic. So she never says the word autistic in the book. Mm-hmm. But the character is represented. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that whole thing of like, being a little bit, like they kind of like give her that gets it's a fantasy, so that part is really cool, but they also give her like the like she has magic, and it's yeah, I'm not very far into it yet, but it's very intriguing so far. So
I just
excited to see.
It sounds really interesting. I also, that's just a really pretty name, the author's name. I just finished reading Lone Women by the author. I can't remember his name right now, but it's the author who wrote the book, The Changeling. And so, yeah, this one is, so it's like kind of historical fiction, kind of like speculative fiction fantasy, but it's twin sisters, and one of them is born as like what their family calls a demon, and so they never use the word changeling, and so I wonder if it's supposed to be sort of that same idea. It was a really interesting book. It's fairly new. I wish it was kind of a slower read, and I wish it would have been a little moved along a little faster, but that one that you're reading sounds really good too. I'll have to add it to my never-ending pile. it feels
Isn't
like, especially
the way it goes,
it really is, especially now with the podcast. I feel like it's like, which is not the worst thing, but there's
right.
Just
the
like,
pile just grows so much faster than it,
yes, than I can get to.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, I am reading right now, I'm actually listening to the audio for Witchlings by Clarabelle Ortega, which is a middle grades novel that's a fantasy, and it's kind of like, it's compared to Amari and the Night Brothers or Harry Potter, or the other one I think it's compared to is Nevermore, which is another children's fantasy series, but it's really cute. It's this girl, this witch who, like in this world, they're called witchlings until they are sorted into their covens, and their covens seal and they graduate and gain their full powers. But the story follows a girl who doesn't get sorted into a coven. So she's what they call a spare. And then there's three of the spares, and so they kind of become their own coven, but it doesn't seal, and so they invoke what's called the impossible task, which is like their world's little like last ditch effort that you can do to not lose your powers if your coven doesn't seal, I guess. And so they have to find and kill what's called a never beast, which is just like a big scary monster. But I really like it. I love Clarabelle Ortega. Her writing is really funny, but this book has a lot of like girl power vibes, and it's very diverse. Clarabelle Ortega is Latina, and so she puts a lot of that into Witchlings. But so I think it's going to be a trilogy, and the second one just came out. But I'm listening to the first one, which is called Witchlings. And then the second one is called Witchlings, the Golden Frog Games, which seems like it'll be very cute.
This is a duology. Unseelie book.
Oh, cool.
Mine, yeah.
Nice. I love duologies. It gives you like a little bit of extra, but it doesn't feel like, trilogies are good too. Like they don't feel like
yeah. No hating trilogies.
No. I finished reading Six of Crows and like I loved it, and so I'm excited that there's another one. And I think I would enjoy more, but like I get overwhelmed when there's a lot of books in a series.
Yeah. At some point you start forgetting what even happened.
Right, exactly. But no, that's cool. So the Unseelie, is that one out yet?
Yes, I think it did come out.
Okay.
Yeah, at the beginning of the year.
Nice. Yeah, I'm a little behind on Witchlings. It's been out for a couple of years, and the second one just came out. It's been on my list forever. I've had an arc of it forever, and I just am finally.
Yeah, I've had this one like sitting there staring at me for a minute, and I'm finally getting to it.
Yeah,
but
I'm such a, and I've talked about this a lot on the podcast, I'm such a mood reader that I just like I love the idea of being able to read books before they come out so I can talk about them when they come out, but it just doesn't happen. Like I think there's been, I'm trying to think, has there been any book this year that I read as soon as it came out? I don't think there is. Like I got the new Emily Henry, but I had already read that. I had read an advanced copy of that. And then I got the new TJ Klune, but I haven't read that one yet because I just read the one that came out 2 years ago. Oh, I did read Lone Women is relatively new. So that one didn't sit on my shelf for too long. And then I talked about this one a lot already, so I won't discuss very much of it, but I read, and I'm trying to like look at it so I can find the name of it on my shelf. The Collected Regrets of Clover came out recently. So I read that one right after it came out. But for the most part, I'm like, I just get to them when I get to them.
Yeah. I feel that. I try. I do my best, but it's very, either I read it within like a few weeks or it starts kind of like going lower and lower on the pile.
Right. Yes. Very much so. Very much so. Very similar. I have she was a previous guest on the podcast, Ray, but I follow her on Instagram and she has like each month she sets a new TBR and it's like 5 books or something. Like she doesn't have an exact number, but it's like a small TBR and she changes it out each month. Every time I see her post about it, I'm just like, that's such a wild concept. Like 90% of my bookshelf's a TBR.
Yeah, so. I've seen people do that and I'm not that person.
Yeah,
I kind of sort of like have a relative goal for this month or agenda mm-hmm. for this month because it's Disability Pride Month. I have kind of like books that I'm like, I hope mm-hmm. here are the books I'm hoping to read. And mm-hmm. this one was one on the list. And then there were a couple of others. But I thought I was going to read them in a different order than I'm reading them in. So there mm-hmm. is that, you know, like that's still like the whole mood thing. Yeah. So, and then we'll see what order if I end up getting to like the rest of them. So there is that too.
Yeah.
But sometimes when it's months like that too, I'm very much like a diverse reader all year,
mm-hmm.
but during certain months, when it's a thing, sometimes I'll be like, ooh, yes, I love this. Let's go all in on the theme. Sometimes I'm just indifferent about it because of the whole being a mood reader thing.
Right.
And just being like, no, I'm doing the thing. I'm just on a certain path. And let me be.
Yeah. I like the planner in me wants to have like my podcast episodes planned out for like the rest of the year. And like, I have a loose like idea of them, but like, I figured out probably a month or two in, I just have to make a big list of like episode ideas I want to do. And then as I get closer to pick them out, because the reading that I do for each of them, like I'm such a mood reader that I can't say this is what I'm going to do. And I'm definitely going to get those read. But I do read a little more of like, I do plan and read what I actually planned a little bit more with the podcast, but just like as a general reader. If it's not for the podcast, I'm just kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
But
no, I totally get that.
Okay. So our episode today is kind of in celebration of Disability Pride Month. We are going to discuss two nonfiction titles. They are Disfigured on Fairy Tales Disability and Making Space by Amanda Leduc. I knew I was going to mess that one up. And then the other title is Crip Kinship, The Disability Justice and Art Activism of Sins Invalid by Shada Kafai. We're going to talk about some sort of vocabulary that gets tossed around a lot in both of these books and sort of in the disability community in general. And then we'll jump into a conversation about the content of the books. So the first like little vocabulary terminology we wanted to touch on was identity first versus person first language. And so that just means that For identity first language, it would be disabled person or autistic person or chronically ill person. And then person first language would be like person with a disability or person with a chronic illness. And that's very like personal and kind of up to the individual you're talking with. A large majority of the disabled community tends to prefer identity first language, but it is very much an individual sort of preference. And so if you are unsure, I just generally recommend listening to someone talk or kind of paying attention to when they talk about themselves, and usually you will pick up, they'll usually use that language themselves. Or you could just ask them if you, I have always kind of equated it to pronouns. Like everyone has a preferred pronoun and you can typically pick up with context clues, but also most people aren't going to be offended if you ask them. And so that holds true for this.
That is, yep, that is correct. And especially like disabled people within like disabled spaces very much don't see like talking about or using the words disabled or disability as bad. Right. So like they're just like, there isn't an issue with like using those words. Like
right. There shouldn't be negative connotation.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
The other term that we kind of want to make sure to talk about before we is CRIP or crippled. CRIP and crippled are generally considered slurs to the disabled community, and they shouldn't really be used by able-bodied people. Both of these words have been used to put disabled people down and refer to them as lesser than. They are, the definitions of these words have been about how disabled people are less than, how they are broken. And over the years, that has been used to taunt and to hurt the disabled community. So that is where a lot of that comes from. CRIP and crippled are now being reclaimed, though, within the disabled community. But that still doesn't mean that it should be used outside of the community. It should only be used by those who are reclaiming those words.
Yes.
And not everyone within the community feels the same way about those terms either. So again, this is like a personal choice kind of thing. And think of it kind of similar to like the word queer. Like not right. Everyone is on the same page about that word either. It's a similar sort of vibe in terms of like, not everyone's going to agree about whether or not it should be reclaimed or whether or not it is offensive. But there is a lot of history about it being used in a negative way toward disabled people. And so it should be a word that's avoided. And a quick book recommendation that isn't one of the books that we are talking about today. If you are wanting to get into more disability stuff, but you really want to start from like the very beginning, I would really recommend reading Demystifying Disability by Emily Liddell. That book really does a great job of covering like disability type of content, covering language, covering words that should be avoided, terms that you'll hear within the community, disability history, that kind of stuff. So if you're curious and you want to know kind of what's all like the basic information, kind of where to start, that's a good place to start, is Demystifying Disability.
Yeah, it's a great primer. I read it earlier this year. The audio is great on that one too. I did that one on audio. I think if you are comfortable reading physical books, it might be one to check out physically because it has some great illustrations in it. But the audio book is great too. I borrowed it from my library earlier this year. So we'll jump in now. We're going to talk a little bit about Disfigured first. Disfigured on Fairy Tales, Disability, and Making Space by Amanda LeDuc. And we're going to talk about some points in that, and then we'll kind of shift into Crip kinship and talk about them a little bit together. But Disfigured is they're both nonfiction. Disfigured reads a little bit easier, or not easier, a little bit less academic, but it is very much what the title says. The author takes fairy tales and traditional folk tales and sort of breaks them down and discusses disability within them, the way disability is used, and what it looks like in fairy tales. She does primarily focus on Western fairy tales. She does touch a little bit on that. She is white and is from Canada, and so she felt like it was appropriate for her to focus most on Western fairy tales. But she does, I should have pulled some out to share, but if you do read her book, in her book she has a lot of great references to this sort of commentary and conversation with some Eastern fairy tales and different cultures' fairy tales. She touches on it a little bit, but primarily focuses on Western fairy tales. I really liked this book. I thought it was very accessible. It was way more accessible than I actually expected it to be.
Yeah, same. And it is very, I was going to basically say a synonym for accessible. Yeah, it does a good job at painting like a picture of like her life and her relationship to fairy tales, and showing us like why she cares so much about this issue, and then getting into the, here are different versions of these types of like tropes and these types of situations, these types of disabilities, and look at like different scenarios where these situations happen.
Yeah. This book is really interesting because I expected it to be more academic, and then I realized as I started reading, I think part of the thing that makes it so accessible is she almost treats it like a memoir. It's definitely not. Yeah, it's not cataloged and, that way. Like it's,
and she even says why, at one actually. Point at the very beginning, she even says, this book isn't meant to be used as, I forget the exact words, and I don't have the book in front of me right now. I didn't think about that. Wow. But at the beginning, it says something like, this book isn't meant to be like an academic take on like disability justice or on like fairy tales or something like that. So she's really not trying to do that.
Right.
Come in here with all of this very like she did her research, yes, but it's also very friend, almost like
it's a very
info dumping about their, almost. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Info dumping is a great way to term that. Yeah. I was gonna say she ties in so much of her own medical history, which she says up front is, and I do like that she made this distinction. Disabled people should not have to share their medical records or their medical information for you to like believe them or understand or respect their viewpoint on something. But she chose to do that with her book to sort of give more of a visualization, I think.
Yeah, to make it more clear of the story that was being told about her own life and her own body, basically.
Yeah.
Through that medical chart.
It definitely like, kind
of was expected of her.
Right.
And she, that's kind of like spread out throughout the book. So it, like, as she shares, like, about, like, a certain trope or whatever, she'll then share a little bit of her medical history and then do a little bit more of that. So you can kind of see the real world application of how this affects disabled people, basically. The author has cerebral palsy, by the way, and she talks about her relationship with that diagnosis and kind of what it was like for her growing up with that and how she think of herself as disabled, in fact.
Right.
Yeah, just that, even that, that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, she pulled in a lot of her medical history. So because of her diagnosis, her disability, she walks with a limp, and sometimes it's more pronounced and sometimes it's not, but she had a lot of surgeries. She also had a lot of surgeries when she was a kid. And so you could see her disability more physically than, like, so for me, my disability is invisible. You don't see any sort of physical manifestation of that, but for her, you did. And so she would get picked on a lot. Or the thing that I liked, and I think part of the reason she pulled in her medical history a lot, is she talked about how, because she didn't walk normal as a kid, quote unquote normal.
There were a lot of aesthetic concerns.
Right. And she also couldn't do a lot of things that, like, so she talks about a lot in the fairy tales, like, you see princesses who are dancing a lot. You see princesses who are very active and who are wearing high heel shoes. And that was something that she couldn't physically do. And so it was a very, like, jarring separation. And so she talked about, I thought it was really interesting the way she talked about internalized ableism within her story, because she says ableism is something we internalize from childhood. It, like, seeps into everything we know. And it took her years to acknowledge and understand how much of it had sort of wound its way into her own life. And fairy tales and other stories like that were a big part of that. She talks about how the stories we tell reinforce this idea of exactly what society expects and likes, and the, like, sort of power structures that they promote. She uses the phrase, it's only a story, a lot, because a lot of people say that about, yes, books or fairy tales or movies or whatnot, like a lot of fictionalized,
especially
stuff.
When it comes to, like, fairy tales, I feel like people have that notion because it's, like, a children's story,
right?
Which fairy tales didn't necessarily start off being for children.
Yeah, she talks about that a lot too. Like, I don't think a lot of people realize that the original Grimm's fairy tales and, like, a lot of the other traditional ones she talks about before Disney got a hold of them were actually, like, very dark. Very gory. And just very, like, yeah, dark is the best way to put it. Like, just, especially if you are disabled or are not what society sort of wants in a person.
Definitely.
Yeah, she talks a lot about how this is a thing that, and this is kind of what I expected most of the book to be about. And she does go, this thread is woven throughout the entire book, but she talks about how our society has always used the disabled body as a symbol of some sort of, like, negative or inner ill. So, like, a lot of times she talks about, like, how a lot of times it's, like, the physical disability, especially, like, scars or, like, some sort of deformity, is, like, how you identify the villain in a fairy tale. Or I'm trying to think what the other one she used a lot was. Just, there was also, there's just, like, oh, the, like, representation of, like, a lot of them. So in the end of the fairy tale, people,
oh, a lot of them get better.
Right, they get better.
Have some sort of transformation.
Right, because of, and a lot of times because of their, like, faith or their religion or whatever. Or they're the villain
or because they have some sort of redemption arc or whatever.
Right.
Or they die. because they're not worthy of whatever. So it's either like you're good enough to be healed or you die, which is kind of how the world views illness, right? Like disability is like you either get better or you die. There is so often no like in between representation of like life with a disability.
Right. And we talked about this a lot on our previous episode, but that's kind of how, like, just in general, like novels, especially for young adults, children, and like early adults, and even just regular adult fiction. But like, I was a teenager always looking for it in YA books. There was no everyday representation. It was, especially for YA books, it was like you magically got better or you had cancer and you died at the end. There was no like, here's just a normal, like, it took the first YA book that I know it wasn't the first one written, but the first like more mainstream one that I remember reading where it was just sort of a slice of life. Like, it wasn't a cured or die at the end. One was 2019 when Sick Kids in Love came out. Before that, it was a lot of like John Green, Fault in Our Stars type of books. And so it feels like that's a thing that's just sort of happening in our lifetime, but this book really shows like, no, this is all like foundation, like the foundation of all of this modern storytelling really is early like fairy tales and folk tales that were passed down and sort of like used as a way to collect like cultural stories and make sure that, because I think she talks about like the Brothers Grimm, like when they put together all of theirs, it was a part of it was to, like, German nationalism. Haven't said that word in a long time.
They were they were like recording all of the stories that already existed and deciding which one was like the correct quote unquote
version.
And this is where I think we should like talk about the social model of disability versus the medical model, because it's very like it, how you look at disability really impacts the types of stories that you are going to tell about disabled people. So the medical model of disability is kind of like the one kind of more mainstream, I would say, way of viewing disabled people. It links a body directly to a diagnosis and places emphasis on the intervention of medicine as a way of solving or eradicating the particular disability or condition. So, in other words, the whole goal with the medical model is we're going to make you better.
Right. Like, we're going to cure you.
You something is wrong with you, you need to be cured.
Or
we need to figure out or we need to figure out where this disability even came from and how to make it stop existing. The social model of disability is very different in that it states that it's actually the systemic barriers, exclusion, and negative attitudes toward those toward disabilities more than the physical limitations of those conditions themselves that are limiting disabled individuals. That is what is disabling. Disabled people is more the systemic barriers, the exclusion by able-bodied people, the lack of ramps in buildings, the lack of ASL interpreters, the lack of whatever it is, accommodations that people need and not being thought of and like not making space for that. And
one of the easy ways I understood it was that, so for my particular disability, if I push myself too hard, if I'm super active for a long time, like several days in a row, like basically I have to pace myself so that I have energy to do the things that I want to do. And ideally, if we live in a capitalistic society, which the second book we're going to discuss, Sins and Valid, talks about this a little bit, but if we didn't exist in a capitalistic society where I had to make a certain amount of money to pay my bills, to like live like a baseline comfortable life, I would not be working full time, because I don't really like full time jobs more often than not do not accommodate my type of symptoms. And so I get tired really easy, or I wake up and I don't have the, like, I physically don't have the energy to leave my bed. And a lot of those, so like for me, the accommodation that is typically missing is like attendance or like extra sick leave or something like that. Like for my job, and I have a great job in terms of flexibility and like understanding, but I still also only have like a certain amount of sick leave before I start losing pay. And for most people, most disabled people, or most people in general, like if you, like, unless you are working a full-time salaried position, even if you're working full-time hours, if you're not a salaried position, you don't get sick leave. So if you don't go to work, you don't get paid, and then you can't pay your bills. You can't buy money, or you can't buy food to eat, like that sort of thing. And so the like general idea from a social model is that like society does not accommodate my inability to work 40 hours a week in the way that is expected of everyone, sort of deal. Because
like it would instantly be like, and the expectation you have to, maybe if you push yourself a little bit more, maybe if you like, maybe you just haven't done enough yoga, maybe you just haven't meditated enough. And if you just try to like sleep 8 hours every night, even though you're in pain, like everything will work out just fine. And it's like,
that's not that, how it works.
That's not gonna cure me, dude. Like,
nope.
If it did, I would be better by now.
Right. And so I think one of the things too that a lot of people don't realize, a lot of able-bodied people don't realize, is that we don't a lot of, especially the disabled people that I've communicated with, and so where the social model, like the place that that comes from, is that we don't see our disability as something negative, and we don't necessarily want to be cured of it. And so I really like the way she talks about in Disfigured. Yeah, she talks about like, who would I, like she talks about the idea of like, oh, it would, like on one hand, like you think it would be great to like not have to deal with all this stuff and you could be like quote unquote normal. But at the same time, it's like, who would I be without my disability?
Like my disability made me who I am. Like right. I went through all of those things and I came out the other side like being this person.
Right. It like defined and sharpened your personality.
And also like, I don't know, disabled people are some of the, I think having a disabled perspective is so underrated.
Yeah.
Like once you realize there's this whole other way of like looking at the world, thinking about all of these other people and all of these accommodations and how can we make this more inclusive for, you know, like it opens, especially because disabled people are so often more patient, are often more, I feel like caring isn't quite the right word. Maybe more intuitive.
Yeah,
like
I think
there's a lot that we end up like kind of understanding and like being okay with. And I feel like I'm already starting to like seep into like the crip kinship conversation.
We can kind of shift into that a little bit because they do start to overlap kind of at this point. So the second book we had wanted to talk about was Crip Kinship, the Disability Justice and Art Activism of Sins Invalid. The book is written by Shada Kafai. Crip Kinship, the book is also nonfiction. It is a book about the art activism, like Sins Invalid is an actual like community that started up out of a.
So it started in San Francisco.
Thank you.
It was like two disabled friends. It was during a time when there were just like so many different events and communities focused on all different types of inclusion and liberation for all of the communities. And they started having conversations because they were both people of color. And they started having conversations about the fact that in the disability rights movement, they didn't really see people that were of their same skin color. And in the queer spaces, they didn't really see anyone of their skin color like taking on like the leading roles and getting that top like recognition a lot of the times. And and at the same time, they weren't seen in those spaces like disabled people. And when they would ask in those spaces, like, hey, what about disabled people? People would be annoyed about that. So it was that thing of they started this out of this desire to create a space that was just for other disabled people.
Which is a lot of what Amanda talks about in Disfigured is like the lack of space.
And the lack of representation. The lack of seeing ourselves as the main characters and seeing ourselves in the same kinds of roles, like seeing ourselves as the princesses, as the heroes, as like all of these different things. And Sins Invalid was actually supposed to be like a one-off performance.
I thought that was so interesting. It was supposed to just be a one-time, like one night, I think, actually, like show.
Yeah. And then it just kind of took off from there and it kept going. And they have like two main facets of their work. So they do workshops that are for like movement growth. And then they do the performances, which is like a cultural experience. And so those are the two different things that they are focused in. And this book really just like is kind of a recap of a lot of what they've done over the years, of their history, but also just talks about like the disabled perspective and why it's important as well. And why like the most marginalized people should be like the leading voices. And so that's what I thought was really cool too. And I think it's really cool that there's a book out there that is already recording this history, because it's not often there's not even that many like disability books out there in the first place. So to even like to already have that record of like, here is the thing that we accomplished, here is the space that we created, is like really cool.
Yeah. And they have, so you can read this book, like this is a physical book that you can find, but they also, their website, sinsinvalid.org, and we'll link it in the show notes. Their website is like a goldmine of stuff. You can find a lot of video clips or even recordings of full performances. There is information. There's like a calendar of upcoming events. There's a lot of educational stuff on there. If you are able-bodied and are wanting to, or disabled and just wanting to sort of dip in and learn more about disability rights and disability justice and that community, they have a tab that's like specifically education, and they have so much stuff. That's a goldmine of stuff on there.
Yeah, they have tons of incredible resources.
Yeah. I want to watch the documentary sometime. I just realized that was on there. But yeah, their website, and you can access a lot of the, all of it is either free or a sliding scale fee. Like a big part of their mission is to not let financial issues be a barrier.
Yeah. So a lot of it is like, even they're not going to like turn people away if they can't pay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very like, even that is like an accommodation.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important accommodation that like a lot of, and we don't have to go like super into this, but a lot of people might not understand about the disability community. Like, oh, for a lot of people with disabilities, you can't work, or
most of us,
if you're on,
make lower pay and have more bills.
Yes. And if you're on disability, you have like a,
you have a cap.
There's a cap of what you can make.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a lot of, it's way too much to go into on this episode, but there's a lot surrounding, like there's a lot of regulations surrounding disability, like receiving disability. And so,
It's not even that easy to get on disability,
right?
And not everyone within the disabled community is going to be in disability.
Right.
A lot of people can't work due to their disability and have been trying to get on disability for like multiple years and
right,
nothing.
Yeah. There's a lot of people in the disability community who are too sick to work, or like their disability interferes with their life too much to be able to hold down a normal job, but are not considered disabled enough to qualify for disability. But anyways, that's a whole nother conversation. But one of the things that Sins and Valid focuses on, one of their accessibility points, is to make sure that financial hardship is not going to prevent you from accessing their work. So it started as a one-night performance, but it, like, and so the like main value of, not value, the main sort of point of the performance, and now what informs all of their work, is to let disabled people see themselves represented in, like, so for the stage performances, like letting disabled people see themselves represented on stage, but also to be able to come to a show or watch a show in a way that is completely accessible for them, because that's such a rare thing. And so they create.
They also think about like the audience experience. Like,
right.
I mean, now that it's like all virtual, people can accommodate themselves a little bit and like create their own like comfy spaces. But they're always like, I've attended a few of their workshops before. I've never been to one of their performances, but every time they always talk about how like, you guys can have your cameras on, like be your full selves. Like, this is a very safe space. And I always love that about them, like how they really nurture that kind of community.
That's such a big thing that able-bodied people might not think about, is we spend so much of our time sort of pretending to be okay, or putting on sort of this fake aid that like we feel better than we do, or we're, you know, whatever. And so for them to like create this community and say like, you don't have to mask any of your symptoms. You don't have to mask any of your accessibility needs. Like, you are allowed to exist fully in the space as you are is such an incredible opportunity and aspect of their community.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it's also really cool because when you first get into one of their workshops, there will often be like the ASL interpreters, like kind of like getting situated, and all of the tech people making sure that the live captions are working, and all of these different accessibility tools that they're like double checking are functioning well. And if anything at some point stops working, they pause everything.
Mm-hmm.
Which is mentioned in the book. They pause everything to make sure that it is able, that everyone has access to all of the information. They take a little moment to make sure, like, okay, I'm not going to speak if the ASL interpreter isn't here for a minute.
Or if the captions aren't working.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just hang with us for a second. They read everything in the chat out loud in case someone isn't able to like read the chat for themselves,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And it's a really cool thing to be in a space also where those things are thought of already.
Right. So it's us having to ask for that.
Exactly. Because so much of the time it's like, it's not assumed that like deaf people will be attending this event. It's not assumed that someone is going to need live captions. Like, the assumption isn't usually like someone needs that, so we should provide that. It's very typically like, if someone needs it, then we'll, like, if some, like, someone would have to say something in order for that to be a thing.
Right. Most of the time we don't go to things that we know are going to not, that aren't advertised as being specifically accessible or that we haven't been to before and know are accessible. It's just, I don't know. It's interesting just to, it almost feels like otherworldly, like even just thinking back on events I've physically attended in the last month or so, which is not a lot. I don't go a lot of places. I went to a drag show last month at a local brewery, and there was a couch in the space, and then there was maybe 6 or maybe 10 chairs. And I was just like, and just the whole sort of environment of a drag show is that you're like up close to the catwalk and you're like interacting. And it was just like, and no one there made me feel bad because I was sitting down the whole time, but it was like, when they started the show, they sort of announced, you know, like, we would love, like, everyone needs to come up close to the catwalk. Like, everyone needs to be like involved, you know, like sort of that's just sort of their like routine. And it's just like, you know, I definitely felt like kind of odd just sitting. I mean, I got up and stood close by sometimes, but for the majority of the night I sat down because I knew if I stood the whole night on a concrete floor for 2 or 3 hours, my body was going to be in a lot of pain the next day, like more pain than normal. And I wasn't going to be able to function the next day, even just by making them virtual. But like the way that they talked about the physical shows, like the first night that they did it, the way that they created or set up the space was so like, they had the ASL and they had like the wide open room and they had the chairs and they had it set up so that nobody felt like
they had a room that was for like,
if you got overstimulated.
Yeah, if you got overstimulated. And they announced like, please don't wear any scents.
Yeah, it was a scent free zone. Yeah. A
scent free zone, which is like something people don't often think about, but even that is like such a big deal. Like that makes such a big difference.
It does. It makes a huge difference. And like, a lot of people just in general don't think about these sort of things unless it's something they deal with. Like I have a coworker who gets really bad migraines and has really bad allergies. And so any sort of really strong scent will bother them. And it's like, most people wouldn't think twice about putting on perfume to go to work or whatever, but like that space is, when you work in such a like closed in smaller workspace, that's a thing that, you know, will affect someone. And it's really cool to have, I really liked how they talked about too with the virtual stuff, like allowing, so creating them as virtual spaces allows you as the viewer to sort of create the environment or like be set up in the environment that is most accommodating to you. And I don't think people realized how vital virtual events were until COVID hit. Like when COVID hit, there were a lot of virtual.
I remember at the beginning of it, a lot of the discourse in the disabled community was, but like, we've needed this the entire time.
Right. Like, this is not new for our community.
We've always wanted and needed, and like some of us have like always done this, like none of this is, like you're talking about this, like this is such a novel concept, like it's very annoying, like, and then when stuff started to die down, then a lot of the conversation became like, it's really annoying that now like all of a sudden it's like there's no virtual stuff really.
Right.
And suddenly, like, those of us that mostly spend time at home because of the things that keep us at home have nowhere to go, like, nothing to do, like, no activities, you know, like, all of those, like, live concerts we could go to before.
I was gonna say, concerts were the big thing for me. Yeah. I'm such a live concert, a live music person. I've always loved it. And the like, I thrive on the like environment, like the physical environment being there, but I'm also reaching a point in my life where like I physically cannot go.
They're getting harder and harder.
And so when COVID hit and there were so many artists who were offering virtual shows, like I was like, this is revolutionary for me. Like I am more than willing to pay to access like a live feed of this concert to be able to see some of my favorite performers in a setting that I just am never like gonna be able to. And for some of them, it was like, one of them I remember was a Scottish band that like rarely tours in the States. And so it was like, I geographically am probably never gonna be able to see this band, but like also I'm getting to the point where unless it's like on a weekend where I have the day before and the day after off, I'm probably not going to be able to physically attend, especially because I live like an hour and a half, 2 hours out from like a major city where most tour dates stop. So like being in the car, like adding being in the car on top of all of that.
Yeah,
and, like,
it's a whole production to go to a concert.
It is.
It's the and driving.
It really
and the standing, the in line first, depending on what time you get there, the standing inside, if it's general admission, or then just standing for the actual show, because like that's what most people do. Like, and then even
there's
if you're
this
like
stigma
seat,
if you like sit down, even if you have a chair.
Yeah. And it's like, even then, like maybe you do want to stand for large chunks of time, but then like you like sit for a little bit and then it's like, okay, but like, this is weird me sitting here. Like, yeah, I definitely feel the same thing with the concert stuff, because that was a very big one for me. Like the ease.
Yeah. And
it was the year before that I did a lot of concerts, but I knew that I shouldn't. Like I knew it was taking a toll on me.
Right.
And it's that thing of, especially with an invisible disability, of like, you can't really tell how bad it is sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's easy for us to keep going and like falling apart inside until eventually we crash hard. And that's no good. That's not how it should be at all. Which is why I loved the concept of crypt time too. The idea of crypt time and the idea of crypt wisdom, like both of those, I'm just like, yes, very much so. It's like crypt time, like we move so often, disabled people move at a slower pace than able-bodied people. But honestly, like, I feel like the crypt wisdom thing ties right in there with it, because we so often, if you just like moved with us, we would have so much value to add that you can't even like begin to imagine. We would change the world. We would blow your mind. The way we, especially during in such an individualistic culture and time, like disabled people are really looking out for each other.
Yeah.
They're really like forming communities and putting into practice these very collectivist ideas. And that is very important to learn and to nurture and to pay attention to.
During COVID, if you had asked the disabled community, like, we could have told you what sort of virtual things worked better, what sort of programs worked, like what, because we've been doing this for so long. Our community is already so primarily online, like we probably could have, it could have been a lot easier for the majority of society if they had taken a minute to be like, hey, what are your thoughts on this? Like, how do you like work through that? So like, we really do have, and that's a very specific example, but we really do have such a different outlook and a different like set of knowledge and information to offer that is often just not thought about.
Exactly. And now, like, a lot of disabled people like continue to provide virtual spaces for each other to hang out in, to participate in, especially like because a lot of disabled people are immunocompromised, and so a lot of them are still very terrified of leaving their houses.
Right.
They're still like, and like honestly, disabled people are apprehensive of the medical, of the healthcare system due to experience with it.
Right.
Because we've been around the block a little bit and it wasn't fun. And so therefore we have a certain level of distrust, and it makes us more skeptical about what the experts say and such. And so I think that there's also this, just disabled people continue to of time online, spend a lot of time in virtual spaces, and look out for each other and form community online, because that's where they can hang out, like both because that's where they can accommodate, and because like it's easiest to find each other too.
Since invalid, like a lot of it is we are so often looking for people who understand, who have, we're looking for other members of the disability community, and that isn't necessarily something we have access to in real life. Like, I only have a handful of friends that are disabled, and most of them, I'm trying to think. No, yeah. I was gonna say most of them I met through some sort of online, but no, like people who I can physically hang out with in my like geographical area, are like, I only have one or two. Also, sorry, apologies if anybody hears a very loud dog barking outside. She's been let out and she apparently has found something very interesting to bark at. But yeah, so we're often looking for that similar experience, and it's difficult to find that in our own geographical community, geographic community. So we're online primarily, which is also why I love that Sins Invalid makes so much of it accessible online, because it is such a beautiful movement and community, and there's so much creativity and so much, it's such an expansive group of people. It's just really interesting to even just to read about, like I haven't even done any of their workshops or watched any of their videos yet. Like I'm so new to their community, but like just to read about it, like already made me feel like super welcomed and super like seen. And I think that's really significant.
And, you know, kind of like taking it back to Disfigured just for a second, like the author talks so much about how like stories help us make sense of the world that we live in, but that they also like take our understanding, they also show our understanding of the world through the stories that we tell. Right. So it's kind of like it goes both ways, right? So the thing is, like, so many of the stories that come from so many of the fairy tales that are told through using the medical model of like, and then the disabled person is healed, they're redeemed, they're whatever, when what really disabled people so often want is to be seen, to be understood, to be accepted as they are fully for themselves. Right. So while there's this like notion from able-bodied people of being of, oh, we're being so charitable by like doing a nice thing for a disabled person, we're being so whatever for including a disabled person, like disabled people just want, or like, oh, wouldn't it be so fantastic if you were healed? Like,
right,
actually disabled people so often don't see that as a curse. They see it as just like a part of who they are, a fundamental part of who they are. Right. And so what they actually want is to also see themselves, the movies, the books, the whatever that they are consuming, whatever form of media that they are looking at, they want to see themselves in that. Which is also like our whole conversation last time was about like all of these books with disability representation. And that was a big part of like what we talked about that time, was so many of our favorite books and kind of like how we found those books and what we loved about seeing ourselves in those stories.
Right.
Because it is like life-changing to have never seen yourself reflected back like on a stage in a book or whatever it is, and to then get that is such a big deal.
Yeah. I was thinking a lot about in Crip Kinship when they talk about letting the most marginalized lead, letting, you know, like it lets disabled people see themselves represented on the stage. Like I was thinking a lot about how in Disfigured, she talks a lot about how all she wanted to do was dance, as like she wanted to be a ballerina as a little kid. Like that just wasn't an option for her because she didn't have the balance. And so I just think about like that little kid version of her, like being able to see something like Sins Invalid and see someone celebrating movement in whatever way you do move, versus like this very specific version of dance that our culture has sort of put together. I just is such a an interesting, like, it's a healing thing to think about. Like, I'm sure
there's, it really, even just reading about those, it really like made me like about the performances, really like made me re-examine, like, oh yeah, why does it be done this way? Why does this like make me feel like a little bit uncomfortable? Or what is it about this that stands out? So much of it is a little outside the box, or very of what we have seen, because right. We're not used to it, because disabled people haven't had that space so much of the time.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's such a, I don't know, like we've talked a lot about like what it was like to find the stories that did reflect our lives. And I feel like in this, like in Disfigured especially, she talks a lot about like what it's like to only grow up with, she talks a lot more in depth about like what it's like to grow up only with negative versions of disability. And so she talks a lot about like the Disney movies and the way that they portray the original fairy tales, and like it's
how a lot of the villains are disabled
or right, like disabled. She talks a lot about like Scar from the Lion King, who's literally doesn't have an actual name, he's named after his physical disability.
Exactly.
Or the Hunchback of Notre Dame, where it's like
he doesn't get the girl at the end.
He doesn't have like the happy ending. It's like such a weird story. That one's such a weird story. So to see the inclusivity and the accessibility of Sins Invalid and the way that they were able to continue on beyond the first original, like singular night performance that they had planned, was just really cool.
Yeah, for sure.
I will say this book is a bit more academic. So if you like, I do want to go back and try to read it more slowly. I feel like there's a lot in it that I might have missed, but I'm really excited to dig into their website. And yeah.
They offer so much education and perspective shifting, and just like a lot of, I mean, culture and movement building, right? Like those are the two, they're two areas that they focus in.
Yeah. It's such a unique movement, I think. I'm really glad that we decided to read this one and talk about it so that we could share it with more people. I did not know about it until we started planning this podcast episode. So I'm excited to dig into more of that and to be able to share it with more more people.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you want to discuss?
I could certainly keep going, but I feel like I touched on all like the main points that I definitely wanted to get to, you know?
Yeah. Great. Well, this is definitely like, this was a sort of a celebration of Disability Pride Month, but this is always an ongoing conversation on the podcast. And then Brisa will hopefully be back in a couple months for another episode. So we are kind of working on the plans for that at the moment. So hopefully you'll get to hear us talk more.
I will be back again.
Yes. And then In case you missed it earlier, you can follow Breezy online at Breezy, B-R-E-E-Z-Y, Breezy Reading. And that's Instagram, TikTok, and then Goodreads and Storygraph as well. And then the two books we discussed were Disfigured on Fairy Tales, Disability, and Making Space by Amanda LaDuke. There we go. We looked this up before, and I've already said it like five different ways. And then Crip Kinship, The Disability, Justice, and Art Activism of Sins Invalid by Shada Kafai. And the website for Sins Invalid is just sinsinvalid.org. Thank you so much for joining us today, Breezy. It was a real pleasure to chat with you again.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor to be back.
Thanks so much for listening this week. Be sure to rate and review and tell a friend about the show. You can find us on Instagram at Tales from a Bibliophile. The Instagram has links for lots of our other cool things like Libro.fm and bookshop.org. Email us at talesfromabibliophile@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. See you next week.